My name is Noreen Shanahan. I'm doing an interview with Pamela Badilla in Hudson, New York, on July 20th, 2012, and it's part of the Oral History Summer School 2012. And I'd like to have Pamela introduce herself.
Yes, I'm Pamela of the family Jackson Badilla, and I am co-founder with my husband Andre Badilla of Diata Diata International Folkloric Theater, which is a family-based production company celebrating ancestral heritage and everyday adventures in life.
Okay. Can you tell me something about where you came from, Pamela?
I was born in Westchester, New York, and lived most of my life in Westbury, Long Island. As I grew up in a community of family, very intense and close family members. My parents had 13 children together, and we were brought up to revere family as the base of everything we try to accomplish, which would be not to consider a career or anything without understanding its impact on family. Even when I went to college, I learned even more how intense my rapport with my family was. And as I developed as an artist, because I came to school to learn to be a teacher, I graduated from State University at Old Westbury as a teacher, but realizing that I wanted to teach differently than would have been the requirement of my degree. I didn't want to teach in a classroom setting only. I didn't want to teach according to a syllabus only. I knew that education had to be something that came from within as well as without, and from every experience that engaged us in the adventure of life. These were educational encounters, and I wanted to incorporate that into a type of an education that would be global. So even though I came to teach at National Community College for a while, I knew I needed to learn more in order to be a better teacher. And so I ended up traveling, and many, many adventures gave me the opportunity to develop a stronger sense of myself and of my path, which I found very, very soon would be to teach as learning. So a reciprocity of community dynamic, which I believe is what made me a stronger person over the years, is because I know it's important to be humble about learning even as we are dynamic about teaching. You must care enough for the lesson to be humble and learn that you don't know. You're constantly learning even as you're teaching. This gave me a good understanding of my path. And everything else came as historically, you know, lessons do come, and also as adventures do flow one from the next to the next. I was able to learn and grow and develop all the way to this moment where we sit together. I am a mother of 10 children, although I gave birth to 7 of them. Their father, Andre Elombe Badilla, Elombe meaning the invincible, Badilla are those who are gifts of God, because they are empaths. They are those who cry for others. They are those who represent a plate. And once you've eaten from that plate which could be discarded, that is Badilla. Those of you who need it, but once the need is done, you might not reflect upon that which you needed a moment ago. You sometimes take for granted, but still, those are the ones who will cry for you or your pain. My husband, being one of those very empathetic people, he guided and protected our family through, you know, making a living through our art. He's a phenomenal artist and painter for 45 years. He painted original fresques of all sorts, abstracts, landscapes, animals, dancing, people, to celebrate a moment in time, which was the gift of nature, a dance of life. And he taught us these things as we learned to develop our family. The mother who birthed the first 3 children and I are close. And we learned that we are sisters and developing a family of now 10 phenomenal children, and we have also 10 grandchildren and one coming. In fact, this month we should be expecting news from another grandchild. So it's a very, very dynamic family that's prolific in giving life and resurgency of life and, you know, the immortality of spirit. We, as Africans, do believe that we come from spirit. We occupy mortality for a time, and then we go back to spirit. And so, as we sit here, I will be speaking of many things that correspond to how we came together as a family, developed over time, living and growing a family through our art. And so the children have been able to understand that you can be a professional in your art, raise your family, pay your bills, if you are willing to make that extreme effort, first in believing in the art, not necessarily to commercialize it, but to believe so much in the message which promotes your creation of it, that it will carry you as it did. And we've had difficult times, oh my goodness, financial setbacks, many sorts over the 30 years that we've been together. We have learned that faith, not in religion, although we celebrate, as my husband calls it, Nzambia Mpungu, we believe in nature. We believe in the forces of nature, that which exists between the sky and the earth and the waters and all the elements of nature. We find God in that. As I sit at this table and look across into your face, I see God in that. We learn to understand the reciprocity, where we give appreciation for our life passage, and which time nature also gives us appreciation for enduring that path. And every day is one day. You can only be where you are, and everything has its time. And when we embrace these three principles for which we teach our children to follow, and for which we endure hardship as well as triumph, we recognize that this keeps us guided on a path, a direction, which makes us understand that we have been chosen for a certain message. That is to teach through our example, family values, traditional values, as well as everyday need values that tell us you must respect others. You must understand that there are differences which have to be, but by respecting each other, anyone in a community becomes family. And then you can deal with people and teach them and enjoy them and celebrate with them and teach them also how to learn, because arrogance blocks learning. And having a predisposed idea about a different culture, it impedes upon learning because it develops a void, which I call ignorance. And that void keeps you from understanding. It keeps you from respecting and looking at them as another human as yourselves. And our message has been very strongly inclined toward helping people learn to appreciate each other across cultural barriers, across generational barriers, and any other thing that could be a barrier. And Elombe, without even speaking English, was able to touch so many people, myself included, because we met in Paris. We used to go out and have a translator there so he could speak to me for him, speak to him for me. And it was fun for a moment, but after a while we realized the language wasn't really that great a barrier. He had a great expression. We had comedy. We had a lot of moments where we were able to communicate without speaking at all.
What was his language?
He spoke actually four languages. And you see how we're saying what was his language? That inclines us to recognize that I always speak of him in present tense, but it is a fact that July 10th, he passed onto the realm of his ancestors and no longer is physically here with us. In fact, I expected this to be a very, very difficult time to talk. And in fact, it's a releasing moment to talk, because we have so great a realm of experience together. I can draw from 30 years of memories that it becomes almost like expressing with great regard for appreciation to be able to. What a wonderful life we've led together. And he has been able to do everything he's wanted to do in the 64 years on this planet. And already I feel his presence everywhere I go, which is a comforting presence. It's also a release of some of the deep and heavy sadness that I was feeling. And I'm sure there'll be moments, but unless somebody comes up to me with their sad faces and hugs and I'm, you're lost, I don't feel a loss, except the physicality that I can't feel his beautiful hands or, you know, touch his face. But even the children have learned to resolve among ourselves that we have been so gifted and blessed to have had that wonderful and intensely close family, which is still that wonderful and intensely close family. And so we are able to say, you know, communication is something that comes from feeling within, an expression of a moment of emotion, any feeling that you're able to successfully transmit to another. And that is not so difficult. Sometimes with words, it's more difficult. You stumble over things that you want to say that don't express how deeply you feel. And so sometimes it's better to smile at someone and say nothing, or to take their hand and say nothing, hug them, say nothing. Or just as he would do for 45 years, paint an original image that shares a moment in time that celebrates being in a place within that moment in time on any given day. You see an image of someone dancing, someone fishing, hunting, animals grazing, portraits of people looking at each other, or some of the more abstract images that you have to figure out what's happening, and it's just a story to be told. Over the years, 45 years, the last day he did that was out on the street of Hudson in front of Nolita, our favorite cafe, because the people are so wonderful there, on Father's Day, June 17th of this year, and celebrating giving. Every time he paints, somebody comes up, he'll talk to them for a moment, and just because they shared that moment with him, he felt so inclined and full of generosity, he would offer. And people felt sometimes embarrassed. They didn't want to accept it. They said, no, let me just give you something. We'd always say, well, if you want to buy one, you can buy another one. But this that I'm giving you is a gift, and a gift does not have a price. Of course, now the paintings are no longer for sale. We are keeping all that we have as a treasure to give to all the children as a legacy for their children's children's children. So the paintings are now as they would have always been with regard to the value of a spiritual gift, priceless. So, you know, I had intended to bring you anyway, one, to recognize the appreciation of this moment. What I'll probably do is give you one of my flowers or one of my paintings. The children all paint. And what we're going to be doing is probably still engaging in paint expositions and sales, but they won't be his. We'll expose his, but we won't sell them. And we'll show that that's where the children got their inspiration and their gift from. But in effect, jata jata, which is step by step in this adventure of life, you know, step by step, international, our family comprises three continents of nationality. And it's a folkloric theater, life itself being a theater of everyday stories, and folklore just being everyday stories of people who engage in one moment in time. And then that moment leads to the next, and then the next, and the next. Before you know it, you have 30 years of a wonderful story, a never-ending story, because each generation of children come on with more story. And as we spoke when we at the gathering on Saturday, you do not die when your story is not ending. Immortality has taken place. And you do not die when your name is spoken. Elombe Badila will be spoken. And you can never perish if you are in the hearts and minds and souls of those who love you. And he will remain there eternally.
Mm-hmm. It's okay.
We give thanks constantly in our prayers, you know, we always have what we pray for, priorities of your safety and, you know, keep our health and all that, keep our family close, keep everybody focused. But, you know, like I always say, at any time, if I had to go back to my ancestors, I would be prepared because we've done what we wanted to do. We've watched our children grow up. That was our biggest prayer. Watch our children grow up, they see this phenomenon they'll become. So you have, everybody's growing up, they have children, the older kids have children, the younger ones, the seven of our births have not yet given birth, but we see their predominance toward family and their intense love of life, that they will all sooner or later be parents. But to see everybody doing great things, you know, he's doing an album, Young Paris Blandu, Tango is pastry chef at Crosby Street Hotel in the city, Gonda Lady Moon is singing and embracing the waves of universal sound with her gifted angelic voice. You know, Chota is a phenomenal dancer, Nkula loving the earth so much that she wants to travel around the world woofing and helping other people just learn and give her knowledge of farming. Nanu, gifted drummer since he's 2 years old, not even two, teaching others through his message. He's a poet and a dancer and gifted. Everybody's doing wonderful things. Alexandra, landscape architect, and builds beautiful, wonderful decor with plants and nature surrounding. Tangula, I mean, everybody. Christelle's in Paris. She's a concierge. She's able to resolve with people sometimes conflicts that they would have, but she's diplomatically able to keep things nicely, you know, diplomatically correct. And DJ is driving with UPS. It's symbolic because every time I see a UPS car, a truck, I say, hi, DJ, to whoever it is in there. They're all DJ. And they're all delivering something that somebody needs from somewhere else that without him, they would not receive that. So it's, you know, that thing we call reciprocity. Somebody has to give what somebody else needs. And all of our children are in some place doing something that somebody needs. You know, it feels so strongly encouraging to have been part of such a creation and development and guiding this family. Mm-hmm. And then knowing we have 10 grandchildren already, even without those seven who have not yet produced children, we see the legacy going on like forever. So it's very comforting. It's very, very, you know, securing to know that this will go on and on. And then to see how Hudson turned out, oh my goodness.
Tell me about Hudson. I've never been
here before. I love Hudson. We bought our house here in 1999, even though when we first came in 97, our reception was not so warm. It was very difficult in some ways because, for one, the population has very, very greatly changed. At the time we came, there was a lot of ignorance. I think is a more gracious way to say it because the words that are commonly used don't express what it is. If I say racism is a word that's empty because it inclines you to think that somebody does not like or is inclined toward a race and not another, does not like another in effect because they predominantly see their own. And that's all perhaps real, but in effect, what happens is that when someone is afraid of another person because that they're different racially from them, or they negate the value and worth of another, or they incline themselves to consider that other to be their enemy only because of the image of the view of them, that word to express that error of human rapport is ignorance. We ignore that same person could end up being vital to your sustenance. When I was drowning in a pool at 17 years old, I jumped in the pool because other kids were jumping in off the diving board. They're floating up, playing, laughing. I said, me too. I jump in, I'm playing, laughing, I flop up. It was cool that I did it again. And I couldn't get up. See, I can't swim. I'm one of those rock people that just jump in and go down to the bottom. And we were at a party for Ehrenreich Photo Optical Industries. They carried Nikon products. My father worked for them. There's a party. And I was there serving little juices at the bar there. And at the end, I was able to go play in the pool with everybody else. So I'm playing in the pool. And I did that. And the second time, I couldn't come up. And I was struggling. And I remember getting very, very tired of struggling. And I stopped struggling. And I remember in my mind crying because I wasn't going to get to see mommy anymore. And then I let go. I died. And then suddenly I found myself on the side sputtering, pulling my bathing suit strap back up. I remember a white bathing suit. I remember that. That was 17. I'm 57, so that's a while. But I remember a Japanese guy had been the one that pushed me to the side, and then he swam away. He didn't wait for me to show appreciation. He didn't need any accolade for saving my mortal life. And I didn't need to know where he came from, what culture he was, what race, that he knew that that was my humanity at stake. And he did what anyone could do if they were able. And because of that gesture, I'm here to talk to you with my family, 10 children, and having wonderful 30 years with my husband, because he did a human gesture and went on about his business. Now, if I said, I don't like Japanese people, what stupidness would that have been? I don't like so-and-so people. I did not know any and had no personal rapport to speak of. What ignorance that would have been had I any impressions of that sort. And it happens in the world. Somebody hates somebody because their parents hated them. People are warring because of how you see God and how you see God, and it becomes an issue. People of the same race, Semite people, killing each other for how they celebrate their faith in God, which would be the same creator, however you say it. To see children killing each other, hating each other, this brings pain to me to see that. So every one of my plays, I try to bring up the subject of a world community.
Okay, yeah. I didn't know. Do you write plays?
I write plays. I've been writing plays. This is the 11th year now in our play, Revival of the Fittest 2 International, will be performed at the Basilica Hudson on August 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2012, to celebrate world music as a bridge toward celebrating world culture as a family. And one of the songs that I'm featuring in the 26 that I've chosen out of thousands, you know, and I don't even know so many that I could have chosen, but I figured just choose what you know. That way, with your limited knowledge, you can say something and people can get the idea that what you're trying to say, as Josephine Baker tried to say it, that it's a family, the world family. And I put one song in particular, which has turned out to be one of my favorite songs. And I actually saw the artist perform it live. I think it was Cummington, Massachusetts. Holly Near, she has this song called I Ain't Afraid. And she says, I ain't afraid of your Yahweh. I ain't afraid of your Allah. I ain't afraid of your Jesus. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God. This struck me as being, yeah, you see, it's all the same rain that falls, the same trees that bloom and give us oxygen. How dare we undermine that wondrous gift that comes every year in spite of our ignorance and pollution and stupidity? Do you not understand that every season, every spring, we are reinforced in the knowledge that we are one world family, and we foolishly ignore that? In the name of how we celebrate faith, we have undermined and betrayed the message of that faith, which is why I don't believe in religion. I just believe in God. And I don't need a name. I don't need prayers that are written. I pray every day. But mine are such that I wish people would learn to care a moment in time, on any given day, where it is that they are, and make a stand for a gesture of simple kindness.
So when you came to Hudson and you encountered ignorance, has it turned around since then? Has your family's impact here changed people's attitudes?
Absolutely. You could see by the Saturday appreciation of those hundreds of people who marched with us in bright colors, celebrating the light of Elombe Badila. You could see it in the Horstrat Hose Company in full honor guard, saluting as we passed. You could see it and the types and shapes and colors and people of all sorts who knew love, unconditional, coming from someone who didn't even speak to them in English, but in the images of light, enjoying movement, everyone having some kind of a movement that celebrated a moment in time of life. They knew that over time, his impact, which was our family's impact, was such that made them understand that the community dynamic required care, simple care. And care is bred from love, which is garnered in respect. This was what we brought. And when we first came here, we were unable to receive that. People were ignorant of African people, and they showed us great disrespect, which is not important to itemize because it's past. And there will be people who might still feel those ignorant ideas. You cannot always reach everyone, but by having reached so many, that effect sometimes, I hope, is contagious and hits a little bit to those who thought differently, who imagined otherwise.
Are you the only African family in Hudson?
We are the only Congolese family, and there are, I mean, Africans of American birth are all over Hudson, but many of them do not embrace their Africanity. They're not aware of their African history. They don't teach African history properly in schools here. I'm an advocate for school reform. I have been since I've moved here. I find that children are taught to be ignorant because they are not allowed to know, and so they must ignore. When you teach the Niña Pinta Santa Maria to kids, babies making little boats, you know, they think of it as some kind of an adventure of these people coming over to discover. They're not taught, of course. Even as they graduate, they never learn about piracy and horrific destruction of cultures, dissemination of peoples, and, you know, the horrific trains that took people from one land to another where they had no knowledge of how to live, and the deliberate genocide of so many people. We're not taught history properly. We're not taught the ancient realms of African kingdoms and how the Mayans existed before invasions. We're not taught the grandeur and wonderful rapport between peoples and their nature, which would show that they were already developed, greatly so, and then invaded and decimated and caused to be in such a horrific state of want that now, when we talk about them as being, what, third world, that means nothing. And then underdeveloped, that means nothing. These are just insults added to injury. And we're not teaching our children properly to embrace the reality of history so that they could know their true place and could honor each other as people on the planet who have reciprocity of need and want and desire and commitment and aspiration. We're not taught to respect other cultures. We're taught that there's a generic culture, European, that is the base of all cultures, which we must all now learn to assimilate into or either somehow abide by. That's ridiculous. And I find that if that's what's taught in school, we will always have problems of bullying. We'll always have problems of lack of worth, of inequity, where people don't realize that education can serve them because it's disserving them. It's a miseducation. I believe it's practically, if not criminal. But as an advocate to school reform, that means I like to see us stop proceeding along a futile path and go back to truth. Well, I shouldn't even say go back because I never was taught truthfully, but I mean go to a sense of humility and truth.
And how do you implement that in practical terms with your children and in the community?
At home, I teach them to embrace the truth of their heritage. I research it. I tell them how to research it. And then when they're confronted with falsehoods, to be brave and speak.
And how are they responded to when they do that?
Mulandu did that, and he got a referral. I think he got even suspended because he dared to tell his teacher, no, Africa's not poor. We have seeds. We have gold, diamonds, manganese, you know, bauxite, sulfur, everything everybody needs. How can Africa get considered poor? And by the way, a continent, you know, he goes on and on. So he's considered to be argumentative and disrespectful, and he got a referral. But in effect, I would prefer that than that he be ignorant and hear my mother, for example. She grew up and had to stand up in class. Her mother, my mother's mother, had to stand up on the day recognized different cultures, and stand up and say, I'm a Negro, and my people have done absolutely nothing to, you know, assure the betterment of this great nation, and sit down. What a foolish and ridiculous lie they taught these kids to say. But even today, what they're able to say are very limited, very almost cliche types of. Every year they go into the closet and drag out the same wrinkly photo of Dr. King and Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, you know, and once in a while somebody else, so you can say, oh yeah, well, got some new stuff, and now I got Obama. But in effect, there are so many needed lessons, and not anecdotal images of people who have made it or have done such and such, but as a people, there should be a great knowledge of the wave of who we are because of who we were. And from that base, teach the essentials of how we have evolved to be here. Then you would know why there's such a rash of ignorance among our young people, such a grossness of denial of self-worth, and why so many people don't want to succeed. They're afraid that they're going to go to a point and they're going to have to be stopped anyway. And the frustration of being stopped anyway sometimes precludes their desire to even achieve, to arrive at that point where the glass ceiling is evident. There is a lot to teach about how things began. Mexicans aren't rushing here because it's a better land. Their land is paradise. But look what's happened to their land. They can't have it as they should. So that's why they're coming here, not because they don't have. Africans have everything in Africa. We were in Congo last December, and we spent a month together with the 9 of us, all triumphantly celebrating the national ballet, dancing, performing, and it was wonderful. And we said to them, this is paradise. You have mangoes, bananas, papaya, everything just falling in your lap. You have everything. The temperature is wonderful. Okay, the mosquitoes, you can deal with that. And plumbing, we can work that over. But you've got everything everybody wants. Why do you want to have with internet cafes and all that kind of stuff? You want everything else, cars. You're going to have pollution already now. I see plastic bags. They weren't having that before, everywhere plastic. Why do you want that? And you say, why not have what you have? Why would you deny us what you have? And then over here, people are, you know, struggling to have a life that makes sense because we're just careening toward more and more clutter of material, this and that, and more electronic, you know, brain infusion, radiation that gives us nothing of real sustenance, nothing of true value. What could be more intriguing and satisfying than sitting across a table, talking to somebody and looking into their eyes and see in reflection in their expression that your words have touched them in some way, rather than going online and send and oops, I shouldn't have said that. Too late, they got it. And I mean, you don't have a real true relationship with someone online. It's convenient. Surely my family has more contact with each other because of Facebook, but would you not rather face someone and receive a letter with a photo in the mail even? And our post offices wouldn't be closing because you'd have more rapport, interaction. There are things that I believe in, but they're simple and they're laid back and they're certainly out of style. And anybody who knows me knows that I'm not politically correct because I believe in things that are not in style. They're not with the world of convenience beliefs, but I still do trust strongly, you know, endearingly embrace certain traditional values. And that's how we were able to raise 10 children, to be so close, so tender, so beloving of their parents and of each other. Not one single day passes without some affectionate gesture. Even if there's an argument or fussing, fighting, they come back to loving each other because there's such a profound base that is, you know, we are a family, be so, not be so. You know, we be who we be. We are of each other. How can we ever betray that for a moment that was unpleasant, which can pass? And every moment does just that, they pass.
How do you all fit in your house?
It's a big house. It's a pretty big house. And even when we have our family reunions, we sometimes go to different places. People are very generous, but we prefer mostly to be right there squished together so we can laugh and joke all hours of the night, you know. Mm-hmm. It's funny, even though we had everybody together this past week for a sad occasion, it was also a rejoicing. And everybody, Gula came back from Mexico, Christelle came in from Paris, we had everybody together. But now they all went back, most of them. But we will have our actual family reunion, which was scheduled to be the weekend of the play. So they're all going to come back. This time, I think, it'll be sad because Papa won't be seen, but we'll have more time to have resolved among ourselves that he's still here.
Mm-hmm.
And in our culture, we know that's part of living, is passing on to a life that is different. And it's as if, you know, your sun set on this life, but the sun rises on another adventure of that same life story.
And He'll be with you every moment. Tell me more about the theater work that you do.
I write plays because I'm a storyteller. And I've been a storyteller since I was very, very young. I used to produce them for my parents with my brothers and sisters. I've always liked to tell stories, and they always have to have a happy ending or not end at all, because that gives the essential understanding that hope is in effect. A sad ending story is like, well, okay, well, why bother even being in a story if it's not going to have a chance to have nice something? And it could be hard middles, but it has to have a happy ending. And all of my plays are, regardless of the subject or the theme, something happens in which there's a resolution toward what could go better. Like the one play which was the hardest to write was And Then There Was One. And I definitely take from And Then There Were None kind of things, but And Then There Was One. So there has to be one hope, one opportunity, one day, one moment, even one place where hope can exist, even in the face of despair. And in this play, over silly things like marble games and other things, it developed into world war. And there were only four orphans left. And each of them was deliberately designed, the costuming and the casting, so you could know it was European, African, Asian, and someone else. And to say that we needed to give homage to these children, victims of the acts of adults' ignorance, which was so prominent and prevalent that it developed into hate. Hate blindly, because there's no real cause. Like being a rebel without any cause. It's like that. You hate just because, and it just got stronger and stronger, and it was killing, 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 killing. And at the end of the play, these four orphans planted a tree, which they watered it with their tears, and they nurtured it with their sorrow and misery. And that was the end of the play. But also, as soon as the curtain closed on that, we reopened the curtain, and we had four adults standing there wearing the same ragged, same colors, but not those rags. They were wearing the same colors, and there were people of the same, you know, ethnicity of those orphans, hugging each other, embracing each other, with a large tree in front of them, so that tree was able to succeed in growing, and the orphans lived and became healthy. And that showed that hope grew and was able to be sustained. So in effect, I cried almost every day writing that play, because I know that the world was going that way. But as I believe, and people say, it'll take a miracle, it'll take a miracle. I'm one who am victim of miracle. My life, even being here, is because of miracle. I would have been gone many times if it were not for a miracle. My parents had 13 children of the smallest birth weight. They didn't expect me to live. I've been in a car accident where the car was upside down. They didn't expect me to live. I drowned. Things happened to make me know I'm here for a cause, there's a purpose. Even my husband, he fell out of a four-story window. On the night of my birthday here, while I'm praying for my life to get better, he was falling out of the window that very same night, and we met the following year. It's so many things happen, and it's such a long, long story, but if him to have survived still falling out of four stories, for me to survive drowning, things happening so that we could meet in the middle, not in his country, not in my country, but in France.
And how did you meet? Describe your meeting.
Well, I was invited to perform with the Le Grand Ballet d'Afrique Noire in Paris.
You were a dancer.
Yeah, and I was in Ivory Coast, And I was invited from there, because people like my work, to come to Paris. I met him in Paris. That's when we had the translator come and talk to us, because I wasn't trying to, you know, first of all, I was very, you know, stand away from, you know, I'm not interested in people, you know, I didn't come here for that. I wasn't coming here to find a boyfriend. And, you know, the first time I was there, you know, he tried to have me go out, and it didn't work out. When I left and came back to the United States, I finished teaching my class at the university. Something drove me to go back. I had to go back. So I went back, and then we got to meet each other more. And
he realized, back to Paris.
Yeah, I went back to Paris, and then we spent time talking, you know. I remember him inviting me to dinner. He said, "Je suis pas méchant," you know. I'm like, "I'm not mean," you know. I'm not. Anyway, little by little, we got to know each other. And I realized that he was, in effect, the kindest human being I've ever encountered to this very moment. Generous and tender. And I saw him looking after three children. You know, I thought that's very rare. You see somebody taking charge of three children when their mother's alive. And, you know, the long story about why they separated, but to see him taking such charge, I admired very greatly and respected that. Over time, got together, and then I ended up basically adopting those children too, before I even gave birth to any. And it was wonderful. Even though it was difficult at first because they didn't like me, I'm not their birth mother. They were hoping their father and their mother for every reason, you know, as children usually do, want everything to be back to whatever they call as normal. But they learned it was okay to be normal with me too, you know. And one day they asked me, "How do you say maman in English?" That's when I knew I'd passed inspection. Mm-hmm. And I told them, "You say mommy." So they started calling me mami. And in French, that means grandma. But that's it.
How did you all end up in Hudson?
Hudson, well, we came to the United States. We moved to America in 1991, and we're at my parents' house in Hempstead, Long Island. And after my father passed, it was very, very difficult, because he was my husband's like best friend, best confidant, somebody who could know, loved him as he was unconditionally. It was very, very difficult then to stay in that house where all those 3 years of memories were made, and even so many years, we'd come back to visit from Paris. We'd go to Congo in the wintertime, come here in the summer. We'd have different, you know, rapport. He'd come back and forth many times. And then after having come home to visit, I mean, just to stay, and Daddy passing away was such a shock. We did not expect it. And it was very difficult to stay in that house. None of the brothers and sisters wanted to live there anymore. We were living there, and it was so sad often. Anyway, little story came to, my sister lives up here, Roxanne, and we ended up coming up to stay with her for a couple of months before we found a place of our own. And we found a place which was really in extreme disrepair, and it had been a squat for, you know, drug dealing and all that. It was filthy inside, but, you know, we said, we'll take it. It took us months to clean out the trash that was still in it, the refrigerator full of rotten food, everything, but we just said, we'll take it.
Did you have small kids at that time?
They were all small kids. Everybody, the seven children were living at home. The oldest was 13. Yeah. And now they're all grown, except for the youngest, who's now 16. But, you know, we knew that something happened to make that be the move to make. So we made it. And little by little, we hung his paintings up in front of the house and sold his paintings. You know, we made what we could make happen little by little. We were struggling. We had no refrigerator, no phone. You know, you learn about values when you don't have a lot of material stuff, because you see what really matters, the children being healthy and us being together in an empty building practically, but just among ourselves. It made us understand how endearing a family was. And I would take paintings down to Amtrak and sell them for him, because he couldn't speak to anybody and he would have felt uncomfortable.
Did he ever learn English? Did he?
He speaks enough to, you know, speak to children. When he spoke at the after school program, he could talk to them. He could communicate with people, but he was very, very timid about it. He knew he didn't speak fluently, so he didn't want to speak English, but he could very well. Alonde spoke four languages fluently. He speaks four languages fluently. He speaks French, because it was a colonial language which was required, even though he left school not wanting to get beat anymore and have that ridiculous symbol put around their neck when they spoke their traditional language. They put human feces around a kid's neck. He escaped that by, you know, escaping it by leaving school, by getting away from them when they come to you with it. But anybody caught speaking their natural traditional language, I'd have to wear la symbole to further degrade their value of their ancestors. They're not permitted to even embrace it. So anyway, he spoke Munukutuba, which is a very ingenious trade language developed among the commercials in Pointe Noire, so they can come from different regions, different ethnicities, and speak a language for trade and commerce. He spoke Lari, which is his tribal language, and Lingala, which would have been considered the national language were it not for the colonial language, which was prevalent and considered national language, because everyone speaks Lingala. I noticed when I went back this time, though, I've been to Congo now 4 times, I noticed that many children are being taught to speak French rather than Lari. And I was concerned about that, because when he came speaking Lari, he said, oh, you speak such good Lari, such proper, you know, Lari, because he speaks the old version, which is proper and, you know, and correct. And the kids who are being taught French is valued more than their ancestral language is a concern to me, because then they're not learning the worth of the base culture, the traditional culture, which came before French. And they're being taught that because parents want them to have a better opportunity to navigate later on in life, to go to schools in France or do whatever. I can understand some of the strategic idea of it, but at the same time, in a greater and more in-depth strategy, I would consider learning your own first before you learn that of another. This is my point of view, and my husband shared that point of view.
Because what language do you and the children speak?
We speak English mostly. We speak French when around Papa always. And now we speak, you know, we speak English and French, but the predominance is English because of the facility of it, the convenience of it. In fact, he had issue with that for many years because the kids come here, they learn English, and they don't speak to him as much. And that caused a lot of conflict, a lot of emotional turmoil, because he would be very pained by hearing his children speaking language and he couldn't understand it. They're joking, talking among each other, and such convenience. But they learned over a few episodes of those emotional turmoil moments that you need to speak with Papa can understand, and they do. And they have a very close rapport with him. They have special handshakes with him, you know, and it's endearing to watch that. So I know, you know, that's something that is not of a pain to me, and that's very important, that not any time, not ever, on any given day, did we miss an opportunity to show affection. Everybody's kissing each other every day, hugging playfully, you know. It's something that every single day, I'm happy to know that we shared that physical affection and, you know, endearing moments. So it's good to know that even without him present, we can't say, damn, I wish I showed my love for him before he was gone. Which I know I have brothers who had that feeling when my father passed. They were crying, not only because they missed their father, but because they didn't show him the love that they bore for him as they would have wanted to had they had more time. And I remember telling Daddy the night before he passed, you know, we thought he was coming home. We were preparing a production. You know, hello, Daddy. Well, hello, Daddy. You know, Grandpa, you know, a song and dance number for his return. And the very next day he passed, and we did not expect that. I lost it. I didn't believe it. Because we were telling him, I told him that night, I said, Daddy, there's just never enough time. Because he wanted me to tell him this story and that story, and then Madeline had to have her turn to visit, and visiting hours were over. It's never enough time. Mm-hmm. The very next day he was gone, but I know I got a chance to tell him many things, you know, and massage his feet and all that kind of stuff. You know, I felt good about not having at least missed opportunity to share affection. And I tell my children that too. If I've taught them anything, if we've given them any lessons, I don't care how well you do math, are you caring people? That's what matters, compassion. If you're living in a world and you have tenderness that you express openly, you have kindness, respect for humans and animals and nature, and you understand your role as steward of that nature, and you realize you must have reciprocity in a community where people are caring and giving and taking, you're good. And if you're honest with people, you'll be welcome anywhere. You don't even have to have money. And I teach them these things because I believe in them. Mm-hmm. I know today that all of the children are such that they are caring, that they're kind, that they're giving, and that's enough. That's enough of a lesson in life. And that's because they grew up in a loving home,
mm-hmm.
where they know that their parents have a deep affection for each other, no matter what we've experienced and hard moments. We've also had many triumphs. And of course, those triumphs are greater by excess than any pitfall, which was evidenced also by the community's reception of him as we proceeded to the waterfront to celebrate the sun setting on this.
Yeah, describe more of that whole walk and how it was set up and who came on it.
It was wonderful. My sister, Roxanne, who we lived with for a few months before we got our own house, she suggested a parade. I said, okay. So we went to see the mayor and we asked him, could we have a, you know, gathering permit and all that and have a parade down Warren Street and proceed? Because we always, people know us to walk to the sunset and celebrate our prayers in front of the sunset often, often, in all seasons. And he said, okay. And it worked out so that then, you know, she gave the suggestion. Then we took the ball and ran with it. We put it online. Everybody talked to, you know, the kids did all the promotion. I was still not in a state to do a lot of communication with people. Even today, I don't like to see a lot of people because they always want to console me. And as much as it is warm and tender, the deepest consolation often comes when I'm by myself and I can talk to him. So it's, you know, it's weird. I love people, but it's a moment right now I can't be among a lot of people. I hope they understand that. But we took the ball, and we got my friend loaned us her truck and trailer. Another friend loaned us a generator, or her generator, another one, sound system, so people could make reflections if they wanted to. And then we just invited people to join us and wear bright colors. That's it. And on the moment, we went to the funeral home. We were there the night before, 12 hours painting that sarcophage, which was it looked like a crematorium box. It was like practically cardboard. It looked like, as they said, it's wood covered, cloth covered wood. But you know, you see staples holding cardboard parts together. It was not a fancy coffin. And it ended up being the most beautiful thing. I even put it in an order for one. My kids didn't like that as a joke. But it was so beautiful. 12 hours. We didn't cry for one moment of it, just painting and making reflections. And I dilled everybody. We couldn't have any cousins, anybody else come to that. People didn't like that. But I said, no. This is a moment among the children, the two mothers. And it was us all together talking and reflecting and having fellowship among those who were most intimate with Badila. And so we were painting and talking and laughing and arguing and painting, and it ended up being the most beautiful.
What were you painting on it?
We were painting scenes of endearment. I make eyeball people. I made eyeball people. He even made some eyeball people. I made a scene of his fresque like he makes it because he taught me how to do it. Gunga made gorilla. Kula made hearts and elephants, and Gonda made scenery, birds. I mean, trees and paths of plants on either side, just going into forever. Saint Papa, his all his praise names, Ilombe, the invincible, you know, feet, because Jata Jata is like walking in between. We highlighted all the flower texture in this thing. We painted gold inside, took the handles off and painted them gold and got bolts so they could actually hold weight. Everything that we knew he would like, we painted all over it. And then inside of it, we put beautiful brown and golden kind of cloth, and we put all these gifts in there, photos, mango, garlic, things he likes, and musicians, little angelic musicians, birds, cranes, you know, all kind of wonderful things, bells, things that he would love and have as souvenirs of us.
Tell me about your hair.
I cut my hair. My hair reaches my shins. I was going to cut it off and give it to him because he loves my hair. And I was going to just let him have it. But my kid said, we got to look at you. And we're not having you bald-headed. But I didn't realize until days later, because I didn't look at myself in the mirror, that they left so much of it. But he got several feet, maybe about almost 2.5, not 3 feet of it. And then I put that around his head, you know. where his head would be, because I didn't want to look at him after I left him, after I bathed him in the hospital with my youngest son. I didn't want to look at him after we put a nice pillow, nice, you know, cloth, and covered him, kissed all over him, all over his feet, his hands, his face. I didn't want to go in and look at him in that box. So we did everything before he got there, his body got there. We put all the gifts in there, then we put the ceremonial ngiri fiber in there for him to lie on. It's painted inside gold. We painted outside, everything beautiful, wonderful, all gold first, and then all the rest was painted on this gold. And the paint itself had gold in it. It was some special paint my son got online. And it's just like, it was so beautiful. You could know that his mortal remains, the body that we came in contact with, the body that we saw and grew up with, grew older with, was very endeared among us, that we sent it off looking so beautiful. And it, regalia, we dressed him in regalia, we gave it to them to put a crystal necklace that Kula gave him, everybody's souvenir in there, and he was laid on top of the cloth that covered those souvenirs, so that it was beautiful. And then the parade was everybody walking down to the river, like we always walked to the river to celebrate the sun. This time, we celebrate light that he brought to the world, at the same time the sun setting on his mortality. And as I spoke to the people, I told them, and I didn't think I was going to be able to talk. All the days before, screaming and crying, but my voice came back to me to tell them who he was. Because we carried him up to the sunset where we actually stand together. And I was screaming out his names and the names of all the kids that he's the father of and who he is, that his name never stopped being spoken, that he'd never be forgotten, that his legacy live eternally, and who he is, and he's the father of who, and 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 that he never be forgotten, that his legacy endure, that he is the invincible, even over death he has triumphed, because he is immortal, that he is beloved, that he didn't need to speak English to be beloved, and that we will now rejoice, knowing that the sun will set on another day, this time in another adventure, of this not ever to end story. And when I said these things, people were comforted, and we were also comforted. And I asked him to accompany us as we go back to bring him his mortal remains to this home where he'll be held until Monday, when we were going to commit him to the earth from which he came. And in that moment, as you rejoice with us when we go back, and bring your smiling, happy faces, and believe that in him being with his ancestors, he is better there than here to suffer. And then we must understand that and let him go and not try to hold on by sorrow, but to release him with joy. And we went back up the street, you know, it took a moment to feel those words.